While regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad to have you with me today. We're going to be talking with Diana Mueller from Women for Gun Rights here in just a moment or two. What to do about the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention? That office established by Joe Biden last year. Nominally headed up by Kamala Harris, but really it looks like the real folks in charge are committed gun control activists from groups like Everytown. Rob Wilcox, for example, who used to lead litigation at Everytown. Stephanie Feldman, who has been an advisor for Biden on gun issues and gun control issues for a number of years. Technically in charge of that office as well. But then again, you know, Kamala Harris, sort of the 50,000 foot level overseeing this office. And so there's been a lot of talk about what should happen to this office when Donald Trump becomes president. Should this office be shut down completely? Or should it be retooled, revamped, rebranded, restaffed to maybe do something a little more Second Amendment positive? In fact, not just a little more Second Amendment positive, but actually turn this office from a an in-house gun control group to an entity that would support, promote, protect, strengthen our right to keep and bear arms while taking steps to improve public safety, to deal with maybe, you know, farm-related suicides, or maybe just suicides in general, but to take the gun control out of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. Diana Mueller is in favor of that retooling, rebranding, restaffing, refocused mission. And I have to say that I am too. So when Diana had this Instagram video last week talking about what she would like to see from the White House, I wanted to have Diana come on the show so we could talk about this. It's not much of a debate, I'll be honest with you, because I think we are on the same page. But we do, I think, get into the opposition to this idea, because there are a lot of folks and folks I like, admire, and agree with on many issues who say, no, just get rid of the damn thing. It's not about refocusing its mission. It's not about a rebrand. And it's not about even firing every one of these gun control activists and replacing them with Second Amendment advocates. In some cases, it's, you know, let's shrink the size of government. We don't need an office like this, even if it's going to benefit gun owners or the Second Amendment. I understand that argument. And in some cases, it may just be, you know, when you get the federal government involved in this, there is mission creep. And something that can start out as a good idea ends up as a bad idea. That's a genuine concern as well. But I think over the course of our conversation, you will hear the other side of that argument as to why a White House office that is actually interested and invested in promoting and strengthening and securing our right to keep and bear arms is not just a positive step, but it's something that, frankly, is needed when we've got the opportunity to put it in place. So anyway, it's a great conversation with Diana Mueller. We had this conversation yesterday, by the way, so if you're wondering what my clothes all of a sudden look like, what I was wearing on Monday, that's why. I had a chance to sit down with Diana shortly before she headed for Cowboy Christmas, and shortly after I talked with John Diedrich of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. But rather than share both of those interviews yesterday, we held Diana's interview over to today. And without any further ado, take a look at a listen. Diana, it's good to see you again. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right. So let's get into the debate. It's not going to be much of a debate because I think you and I are actually on the same page here. But there is a lot of talk about what to do. First of all, like, you know, what to do with the ATF, right? You're going to shut down the ATF. You're going to move it over to Treasury from Justice. What are we going to do with the ATF? But then the other big question is what to do with the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which was set up by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris a little more than a year ago. Has basically become a jobs program for the gun control lobby, but has also become a bully pulpit for the gun control lobby, right? I mean, they are not only able to message to the American people, but they're able to direct, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funds to, you know, anti-gun groups, in some cases to, you know, violence prevention programs, but to states to, you know, adopt red flag laws. So I think every Second Amendment advocate that I've talked to is on the same page that the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention needs to stop. The question is, do you replace it with something or do you just scrap it entirely, right?
Right. And I had put up a, because my position is that we need to rename it, we need to repurpose it, and we need to restaff it. And I put up a video to say, hey, you know, audience, what do you guys think? And honestly, there was a lot of, you know, just knee-jerk reaction, abolish, 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 it's unconstitutional, blah, blah, blah. And I'm pushing back and I'm like, guys, listen, dig into this and understand that what we are up against, what I don't think we understand is that the amount of effort and organization and money that they put into propagandizing and marketing against the Second Amendment. And that's where I'm like, we need to do the same thing that they do. You can't just rest on this is a constitutional issue. You have to really intentionally look and help the citizenry understand the Constitution. We've dumbed down our kids so much and our generations after generations that they don't teach civics. So it's my position is that I want to repurpose it and I want to teach the Constitution. I want to teach the Second Amendment. I want to teach people how to shoot, or if not shoot, understand firearm safety. I want to research firearms, safety, gun violence, if you want to put it in air quotes, violence perpetuated, you know, any kind of violence. There's a lot of things that people can do that don't require a firearm to be safe. Let's talk about those things. Let's educate our citizenry as to how you can look for predatory behavior, how you can prepare to protect yourself and your family and actually be safer. We have the solutions on our side. We have to get up through all of these hurdles, whether it be social media, whether it be all of these anti-gun marketing messages. We have to get through those. And I feel like this is an opportunity. We need to take these headwinds that we have with this mandate that we saw in November and take them back to the people and say, this is why we believe what we believe.
I'm right there with you. I think it would be a mistake to just shut that office down and scrap it entirely. I like the idea of replacing the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention with something that is going to be not only just an educational arm, right? Because there are so many different components to this. There are so many things that a pro Second Amendment White House office could do. Whether it, you talk about education and training, you know, instead of directing these hundreds of millions of dollars to promoting red flag laws, what if instead we spent a fraction of that money? Again, being good stewards of government, right? We want small government, but let's redirect some of those funds to range access, right? To ensuring that people don't have to travel hours away to get access to a range. I mean, again, it's been almost 15 years since the McDonald decision struck down Chicago's handgun ban. There is no gun range in the city of Chicago. Right. In the state of Massachusetts, I believe there are no publicly accessible ranges. There are privately owned ranges that may be open to the public. I think there are four of them. That's it. What benefit could we see just by giving people the opportunity to go and train on a regular basis in these range deserts? Right. I mean, that's one aspect of this.
Range desert. I like that.
Well, I mean, if we've got food deserts, right, why not a range desert?
Talking about money here, and I don't think I just looked up the Biden proposal for the Office of Gun Violence Prevention was $15 billion. The proposal was $15 billion. And out of that came the Safer Communities Act, or the bipartisans. They like to put it in there, bipartisans.
Right.
And that was $1.5 billion-ish. So we're talking about $1.5 billion going to propagandize against the Second Amendment. So I don't like that they created an office out of thin air and they got all this money to it, but I'm prepared to go toe to toe with them. And that's what I'm proposing. I'm proposing that we rename it to the Office of Firearm Safety and Violence Prevention, and that we put people like John Lott in there, that we put people like historians like Ashley Lubinsky in there, somebody from Women for Gun Rights. I would love to see the Heritage Foundation, NSSF, NRA, GOA, all of the, you know, let's have a think tank of people who are truly constitutionalists and know about firearms and know about violence.
I think that's a great idea. And I think there are so many areas where we can make inroads. And as you say, look, the other side isn't going to give up, right? I mean, the next time a Democrat gets elected to the White House, what are they going to do? They're going to revive the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, right? Because they understand that that platform matters. And so, you know, I understand the point of view of just shut that office down. It's no good. But I think it is short-sighted, right? We now have the opportunity to I don't want to say play the gun control advocates game, but they're really good at playing the long game, Diana. And there is nothing wrong with taking a bit of their strategy and saying, you know what, we're going to use that to our ends, right? So we're going to have that bully pulpit. We're going to be able to reach the American people. We're going to be able to promote programs that do address violent crime, that do address suicide, that do address accidental shootings, but do it in a way that doesn't impact our right to keep and bear arms. Instead of talking about red flag laws, we can talk about voluntary storage laws, right? Where, you know, groups like Hold My Guns, the Wisconsin Gun Store Project, right? Things that don't involve government action and government agency, but actually encourage individual agency. We can promote responsible gun ownership among, in urban areas where, again, gun ownership is just seen as culturally taboo and frankly, a criminal offense, right? There is so much, I think, positive outreach and positive steps that can be taken if we're not afraid to seize that initiative, right? And to move forward with this. I mean, I'd love to see a project. I mean, listen, I'm a rural white guy who just turned 50 this year. So I am now officially in like the prime demographic for firearm suicides. I would love to see a White House office of, you know, firearm safety and violence prevention that talks to people like me, that talks to, you know, rural older men and says, here's why you need to stay alive, right? Here's why this is not the right option. This is not the step you need to take. That's not being done in the Biden administration. Their idea is don't own a gun, right? And their problem solved. Let's actually get to the root of these issues here.
How compassionate is that? That's what I've always said, that what's the compassion in somebody having a mental crisis and they're a threat to themselves or others, and you go up and knock on the door, these red flag laws, and you say, give me your gun so you can't hurt anybody. There's no compassion in that. There's no solution. There's no help for that person. So there are a lot of great programs. And think about, let's go back to the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. You know, a lot of that money is being shifted down to the states, and they are pushing, they're giving money, they are giving language, they are helping them craft bills, anti-gun bills. So your money, your taxpayer money, is being used against your Second Amendment. So I just really hope that, you know, we can find an audience with somebody and have a conversation, and that might be within our own circles of like, what would we like to see? You know, who would we like to see the head of the ATF and those kind of questions. But we are so fragmented that it's really tough to get everybody in the same boat and grab an oar and go in the same direction. So I'm hopeful that we can find an audience with someone with the Trump administration, and that we can talk to them about renaming it Firearm Safety and Violence Prevention Office.
Have you had any conversations with any members of the transition team?
I haven't had any conversations, no official conversations, but I put some feelers out there, and you know, we've done interviews like this, and we put out a press release that's what we'd like to see. So we'll see if we've got some lines in the water, and we'll see if we get any bites.
Well, I mean, I think Ryan Petty and Aiden Johnston had a piece in the Washington Times a couple of days ago talking again about the idea of rebranding and refocusing a White House office. I think they had a slightly different name, but again, the same general idea that what you're talking about here. So you're right that when you're dealing with, you know, tens of millions of rugged individualists, it's kind of like herding cats to get us all on the same page. And there's going to be plenty of disagreement and discussion. But this is an opportunity. This moment is an opportunity, right? And if we're talking about the election of Donald Trump representing fundamental change in Washington, D.C., Well, let's talk about what that means in terms of our Second Amendment rights. Let's talk about what that means in terms of the federal government's approach to gun ownership and that Second Amendment. And it goes beyond, you know, repealing the ATF's rules that were enacted under Joe Biden. It really is about replacing this anti-gun philosophy with one that recognizes the fundamental importance of our right to keep and bear arms. And again, pays more than lip service to the idea of, you know, reducing violent crime, reducing suicides, things of that nature. But doing these things in a way that respects our Second Amendment rights and is effective at making the United States a safer place. And that can be done, but it would be and I just don't want to see that opportunity wasted. I think you and I are on the same page there. We just don't want to see this opportunity pass by.
Right. Well, and what they're so good at is influencing the citizenry, the masses. You know, we all have influence with our friends, our families, our communities, and our legislators. But I think that the constitutionalist in us is like, you know, we're gonna handle this at the legalistic and the law. You know, we're gonna let the Constitution stand, and in Washington D.C. we're gonna lobby against certain bills and push certain bills. But that's not winning the hearts and minds of your friends, your families, and your communities. And that's what they're doing. So I encourage all of us, in this space to really understand that this is an opportunity. This specifically, our topic today is an opportunity, but also to educate themselves on why we oppose universal background checks, why we oppose red flag laws, why we oppose, you know, safe storage. There are reasons. And if people need help, Women for Gun Rights has a one-page document, talking points document on our website. You just go on there, you download it. So if you're ever going into an interview, you're ever going to the Thanksgiving Christmas table, and you want to brush up on those things, just download that and take it. But be intentional about learning those things and having those conversations, because that's what's got us in such hot waters. We're not having these conversations in our choir really doesn't know the words to the song.
That's right. And I mean, listen, the bottom line is, you know, while there are tens of millions of gun owners in this country, and I think, you know, you have Gallup or Pew, and it's something like 40%, maybe almost 50% of the country lives in a home where there is a firearm. Gun owners themselves are not a numerical majority among voters. So if we're just talking to ourselves, and that's all of our messaging, we're doing ourselves a disservice. Because we have to engage in outreach. And look, not every non-gun owner is a gun control activist. But the gun control lobby, I think, is very smart at recognizing, okay, here's this untapped pool, right? We need to, as you say, we need to go after those hearts and minds too. We need to explain to those Americans who don't choose to exercise their Second Amendment rights why it doesn't make sense to have universal background checks, why things like a one-size-fits-all storage mandate is bad. It's not just, you know, that it's the wrong idea, but that it is actively going to hurt some people. And again, you don't do that just from, speaking to fellow gun owners at the NRA annual meeting or at, a GOA event, right? You've got to get in the arena. You've got to start talking to those folks who would not listen otherwise. And again,
not
I think that
not all gun owners are Second Amendment supporters.
that's very true too, right? So there is also persuading those gun owners to become Second Amendment activists and become advocates, right? And that is a crucial role to play as well. So again, I'm on the same page. I wish we could have a debate about this, but on this issue, you and I think are pretty firmly in lockstep here. But I do want to have you back at some point in the future to talk more about this, and hopefully we'll get some good news from the incoming Trump administration about what they plan to do, both with the ATF and the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, and a refocused mission to preserve and protect these Second Amendment rights that we all hold so dear, in addition to making this country a safer place.
Well, thanks for having me on and talking about it.
Absolutely. Diana, if folks want more information about Women for Gun Rights, how do they find it?
Womenforgunrights.org. And then we're on Instagram, Facebook, all the usual suspects.
Awesome. All right. Listen, I look forward to talking again very soon. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, too.
My thanks to Diana for joining us on the program. You know, I mentioned Ryan Petty and Aidan Johnston's piece of the Washington Times during our conversation. Ryan is going to join us on Monday to talk about his column and their ideas, what he'd like to see from the White House and what he has heard, perhaps from the transition team. So stay tuned for that again on Monday. Tomorrow, by the way, we'll be talking more about the future of the ATF with retired ATF Deputy Assistant Director Pete Frisella. So be sure to tune in for that as well. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Iowa City, Iowa, where a man sentenced to 2 years probation for firing shots near the Iowa City High School. As it turns out, this individual, already known to law enforcement, 39-year-old Lawrence Russell, pleaded guilty to possession of a firearm by a felon, which is a Class D felony, on December the 9th. He was sentenced to 2 years probation with a 5-year suspended prison sentence the next day on December the 3rd. Now, according to the Iowa City Press Citizen, any further violation of the law would land Russell in prison for 5 years with time credit for time already served on this charge. Now, I would say could land Russell in prison for 5 years, not would, because we've seen this time and time again. Somebody gets a suspended sentence, they're put on probation, they're told you keep your nose clean because if you step out of line, man, you're going to prison. That entire sentence is going to be served. And then they violate their probation. It doesn't happen. They get another slap on the wrist and they go on their merry way. Now, in this case, Lawrence Russell wasn't originally charged with just possessing a firearm as a convicted felon. Police responded to reports of shots fired on November 8th of last year, and they found shell casings outside of Russell's home a few blocks east of the high school. The high school was locked down as a result of the gunshots, prohibiting students from leaving at the end of the school day. When police searched Russell's apartment, they found a rifle, as well as photographs of Russell holding the rifle in his living room. They said that Russell was, quote, uncooperative with the investigation, that he claimed that he hadn't heard any gunshots. And the Iowa City Press Citizen says that Russell remains barred from possessing weapons because of two prior convictions in another state. Uh-huh. His guilty plea and his sentence were for non-habitual felony possession of a weapon, which carries a lighter punishment than for habitual offenders. Given the two prior convictions, I'm not sure why Mr. Russell would not be considered a habitual offender, but there you go. All is fair, I guess, in love and war, but boy, we get an awful lot of unfair plea deals that certainly benefit the defendants more than the interests of justice, and I would argue that that is the case here with Mr. Russell's guilty plea. On to today's Armed Citizen story. From Rochester, New York, where a suspected home intruder was killed by a family member who had just moved into this home. This was their first night in the residence, according to the news in Rochester, New York. This was Channel 13, WHAM. They report that I think this was Sunday evening, Sunday morning, about 5:25 in the morning. 22-year-old Zymar Thacker found dead inside a home on Emerson Street when police responded to a report of a break-in. Investigators determined that Thacker and others had broken into the home. WHAM reports that the home at that point was occupied by two adults and five children, 13-year-old, 6-year-old twins, a 3-year-old, and a 7-month-old. The family all asleep in the same room on the second floor. They had just moved into the home the day before. And as WHAM reports, an adult male resident heard the suspects breaking in. He went into another room on the second floor, grabbed a handgun, and then as Thacker walked up the stairs, WHAM says a shootout between the intruder and the homeowner ensued, during which Thacker was shot dead. The resident was shot as well, thankfully hospitalized with non-life-threatening injuries. He has since been released from the hospital. Police say that the shooting of Thacker appears to have been justified. He was not where he was supposed to be. The homeowner, on the other hand, was, even under New York law, allowed to protect himself and his family from violent intruders. No charges related to his death are expected. An investigation is ongoing. However, no arrests have been made for the other suspects that broke into that home as well. But we'll keep our eyes open for any more updates out of Rochester, New York, as they become available. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Sorry about that. Oceanside, California, where neighbors saved a man who was bedridden shortly before an explosion destroying the entire home on Sunday afternoon. This was about 3:45 Sunday afternoon in Oceanside, California. Smoke and flames could be seen shooting out of the garage door when firefighters arrived there. They started fighting the flames in the garage. There was an additional engine company that entered the home to look for an occupant who was reported to be there. They actually found him in the backyard because neighbors had already gotten him out of the burning home as firefighters were arriving. Fire department in Oceanside said they tried to ventilate the home by cutting a hole in the roof, but before they were able to do so, three large oxygen tanks that were superheated exploded inside the home, causing firefighters to retreat to battle the flames from the outside. The bedridden adult, who I'm guessing was using that oxygen, taken to the hospital for evaluation as a precaution. One firefighter was injured, sustaining a knee injury while carrying the man away from the home. Took more than an hour for crews to douse the flames. Apparently, this started by an unattended cigarette. So I know I don't have to tell you this, but if you have oxygen tanks in your home or in your car or wherever, don't have open flames around them. Don't smoke around an oxygen tank. That is a recipe for disaster, as clearly was the case in Oceanside, California. Home fully destroyed. Red Cross has been called in to assist four other residents who were displaced by the fire. And again, the individual who was taken out of the home by the neighbors, I guess, is doing okay, at least as related to the fire. Obviously, the underlying conditions that caused that individual to be bedridden, still having to contend with, but they're at least able to contend with those issues because of the quick thinking and the fast actions of these heroic neighbors in Oceanside, California. Speaking of bedridden and oxygen, I suppose now would be a good time for a TMI update on Miss E for those of you who are following along and are giving us your thoughts and your prayers. I certainly do appreciate it. I wish I had better news to report, but things have not gotten substantially better since yesterday. She is still having some significant issues breathing, still getting fluid drained from her lungs. They're doing a CT scan, actually, probably as I'm taping this, to see what's going on, because one of her lungs apparently is kind of flattened out and is not reinflating the way that they would like. So she is still struggling, very much could use your thoughts and prayers. And you know what? I'll go ahead and say I could use them too, because I got to say, I think this is the fifth, I've lost track, but I think this is the fifth hospitalization for Miss E since August. And I'm a pretty positive person. I'm a pretty optimistic guy. But I think yesterday afternoon, as I was driving over to the hospital, which is about an hour away from where we live, I finally reached my tipping point of, this is undeniable. This just sucks. So if you can spare a thought or prayer for me as well, I want to make sure that I am the best Cam that I can be for Miss E. And I could use some prayers in that regard. So thank you again for caring. Thank you for paying attention. I'm going to keep working this hybrid schedule that I was working yesterday and today. I'll be doing some writing for Bearing Arms in the morning, then spending the afternoon and the evening at the hospital with Miss E. But we'll have another edition of Cam and Company coming up tomorrow. I unfortunately will not be able to be a part of the VIP Gold live chat with Hot Airs at Morrissey. Actually, I'm going to try to join from the hospital. I just don't know that the internet connection is going to be great enough. But we'll muddle through as best we can. And again, in addition to your thoughts and prayers, I certainly do appreciate your patience and your support. This is not how I want to be spending my week. This is not how Miss E wants to be spending her week. We both want to be back at work full time, but unfortunately, it's going to take a little time before we get there. So thank you again. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. And until then, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. Tom Knighton keeping you up to date on all the latest Second Amendment news and information. And I am doing some writing as well. Got a VIP piece taking a look at Clarence Thomas's rebuke of the Hawaii Supreme Court coming up later today. And we'll be paying, again, close attention to everything else going on with our right to keep and bear arms. A lot of court activity this week ahead of the Supreme Court taking a look at Snope versus Brown, the Maryland so-called Sullivan Band case. And again, we've got all of that covered for you at BearingArms.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.